This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, an ABC investigation exposes China's vast network of secret ethnic gulags. And social media erupts over a Queensland fish and chip shop controversially named The Battered Wife.
My little shop in the middle of a little town in far north Queensland is causing this much of a ruckus. I hope that they start putting their energy in and trying to change what's going on.
At least 15 members of the New South Wales Young Nationals have resigned after the ABC revealed a push from far-right fringe activists to infiltrate the party. The resignations include at least four men identified as having links to alternative right groups. Alex Mann from the ABC's Background Briefing program broke the original story nearly 3 weeks ago, and he joined me a short time ago to talk about the developments. Alex, what do you know about the people who've resigned from the Young Nationals?
What we were able to find by looking around in a number of closed Facebook groups and by a little bit of monitoring their activities in the real world as well, was that these guys had connections with a lot of far-right and extreme material. They were talking online about their plans to join and influence major parties from within.
And what is the National Party organisation saying today?
Since the very first moment that we brought this story to the attention of the New South Wales Nationals, they've been quite strong in condemning the behaviour and the conversations and the posts of the young men that we've identified. And over time, they've conducted an internal investigation, which identified about 18 people that they suspected of being involved in this far-right push within the party. The latest from late yesterday was that a letter was sent by a number of the people who were identified as suspected of having been involved in this push, and the Nationals have committed to continue their investigation, and the result of that investigation is due to be handed down on Thursday or Friday this week.
Now, your reporting's revealed that far-right groups are trying to infiltrate mainstream political parties in Australia. In a broader sense, what are they actually trying to achieve?
What we were able to identify by looking at what they were saying online is that this is a movement, a group of people who talked in great detail about the kind of Australia that they wanted to live in. They talked about problems with immigration policy. They talked about the desire for an ethno-nationalist state. So these were people who had an affiliation with fascist politics, and what they wanted to do was move Australian politics in that direction.
And that's Alex Mann from the ABC's Background Briefing program. An ABC investigation has exposed China's vast network of secret ethnic gulags. Via high-resolution satellite imagery and Chinese government contract databases, it shows for the first time the scale and rapid expansion of China's controversial re-education camps. The data was provided by analysts at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Dylan Welch from ABC's Investigations reports.
These Uyghur children are reading from a lesson called I Am a Law-Abiding Citizen. The video was broadcast on Chinese state media earlier this month in response to growing international outcry over the detention of ethnic Muslim minorities in a network of camps in the country's restive province of Xinjiang.
What we're looking at is a system that is being rolled out at an incredible pace, the scope and scale of which is absolutely massive.
Fergus Ryan is an analyst for ASPI's International Cyber Policy Centre. He's one of a group of researchers who have spent the last 3 months poring over satellite maps, contracts from Chinese government tender databases, as well as videos, articles and photos from Chinese media to prove not only the existence of the camps, but their staggering size and disturbing role.
A vast, sprawling network of camps, of indoctrination centres, essentially, where the people who are being detained there is an attempt to really rewire their political thinking and erase their Islamic beliefs.
The researchers examined 28 camps and found they had doubled in size in the last year. In just the past 3 months, they've grown by 600,000 square metres, about the size of 30 Melbourne cricket grounds. Mohammed Atawalla is from Hotan County in southern Xinjiang and has been studying in Turkey since 2016. He told the ABC that his mother, two brothers and a brother-in-law are all held in the detention camps.
The detention destroyed my family. I cannot bear keeping silence because I start to think there are genocide.
Since he left China, he's been sent a series of audio messages from Xinjiang security officials who are trying to cajole and threaten him into returning.
He says, if I trust them and do what they say, things will be okay. If I don't do what they say, let's see.
And you think the let's see is a threat?
Yes.
And that's Uyghur Mohammed Atawalla speaking there with reporter Dylan Welch. The Chinese embassy in Canberra declined to be interviewed for this story. 6 days out from the crucial US midterm elections, and Donald Trump is conducting a campaign blitz in the final days. While the president's name's not on the ballot papers, the results will determine his future legislative plans. In recent weeks, Mr. Trump sought to focus the campaign on immigration, and a few hours ago he declared the world was laughing at America's border protection laws. But some of his opponents appear very confident of success, with one senior Democrat declaring her party will win back the House and make other gains. North America correspondent James Glenday reports from Washington.
Barbara Comstock might as well be Barbara Trumpstock.
Across the United States, voters are being bombarded with political advertisements. And even though the president won't be on the ballot paper on Tuesday, the Trump name features prominently. In some areas, it's seen as a negative.
Barbara Trumpstock. Everything that's wrong in Washington.
In others, an electoral asset. This comical effort by the wife of Florida gubernatorial candidate Ron DeSantis is perhaps the most notable example.
Ron loves playing with the kids.
Build the wall.
He reads stories.
Then Mr. Trump said, "You're fired." I love that part.
Of course, the commander-in-chief has no real problem being front and center. He's actively trying to put himself there.
So I'm going to one of my favorite places in the world, Florida.
He's heading south for a so-called Make America Great Again rally, the first of 11 he'll attend over the next 6 days. And as he left the White House, he returned to the issue of immigration and the caravan of migrants heading north.
As far as the caravan, which is very dangerous, you see what's been happening. Our military is out. We have about 5,000, we'll go up to anywhere between 10 and 15,000 military personnel on top of border patrols and everybody else at the border. Nobody's coming in. We're not allowing people to come in.
The president accuses the Democrats of being weak on border protection, but his scorn isn't solely reserved for his opponents. Yesterday, the House Speaker Paul Ryan threw cold water on Donald Trump's pledge to use executive action to end the automatic right to citizenship for babies born to foreigners in the U.S.
You cannot end birthright citizenship with an executive order. We didn't like it when Obama tried changing immigration laws via executive action, and obviously as conservatives, we believe in the Constitution.
A few hours ago, the president responded, tweeting that Mr. Ryan should be focused on holding the Republican majority in the House instead of giving his opinions. It is the House where Democrats are most confident of taking control. Appearing on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi claimed her party is now sure to make gains.
Well, let me say this. Up until today, I would have said if the election were held today, we would win.
What happened today that changed that?
What now I'm saying is we will win.
Some polls and turnout figures suggest the Democrats are on track to perform well, but the party was also confident Hillary Clinton would beat Donald Trump 2 years ago, and senior Republicans insist it's too early for anyone to be claiming victory yet. In Washington, this is James Glenday reporting for AM.
By most measures, Australia is a rich and developed country, but not everyone is sharing in the good fortune. New research out today from the Australian Child Rights Task Force shows our most vulnerable children are falling even further behind. One in five is starting school developmentally disadvantaged. One in six is living in poverty. One in seven has experienced a mental disorder. And youth suicide is the leading cause of death among children and young people. Louise Creeley has the details.
We aren't safe. We don't know our rights.
Please allow me to see my family.
Try to keep siblings together when going into care.
I do not feel very safe in this place they call Australia.
Stop and listen to us.
These are the words of Australian children. Their voices are at the core of a new report into what it's like to be a child or young person from a vulnerable background in this country.
Some children in my school are harmed at home.
Freyana Irani is a senior policy advisor at UNICEF and the co-researcher and co-author of the report.
We know that there are particular characteristics that make children and young people in Australia vulnerable. That includes their ethnic background. It includes whether they identify as LGBTIQ+, children with disability. It also includes a whole bunch of lived experiences, children who've been in out-of-home care or who've experienced homelessness.
Ms Irani spoke to more than 500 children in 30 towns and cities across the country to get a picture of what's going on, but says the most alarming part is that none of what she heard is new.
It's concerning that we keep needing to go over the same ground over and over again, and we're not seeing positive improvements for children and young people in Australia.
She says Australia's children need real action and commitment now, including a national plan for children, a national children and family strategy, and a dedicated minister for children.
Well, there are 190 recommendations in this report, so there is no shortage of work that can be done. But what's quite critical would be the initial recommendations in this report, which essentially speak to a framework for children and an agenda for children in Australia.
Ms Irani says one of the glaring concerns from the report is the entrenched systemic disadvantage experienced by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in every area.
They continue to be the most educationally disadvantaged group in Australia. Last year, one in four Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children clients using homelessness services was a child under 10. We know that since the apology to the Stolen Generations in 2008, the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children removed from their families has more than doubled.
Leanna Buchanan is the Principal Commissioner for Children and Young People in Victoria. She says, unfortunately, the data is unsurprising and echoes what she sees day to day.
We like to think of ourselves in Australia as a civilised country that protects our children and nurtures our children, but the reality that I see, and I'm sure my counterparts around the country see, is that in fact we let many, many children down.
Victoria was the first state to establish a children's commissioner with a dedicated focus on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, which is one of the recommendations in the report. The commissioner says it's been a success.
And I have to say it's brought a focus to the issues for Aboriginal children that we've never had, and that has seen Victoria start some real change, really start to bring together government, non-government, the Aboriginal community, and have those different parties working together with the prospect of real reform.
Linda Burney is the Federal Shadow Minister for Families and Social Services and the Shadow Minister for Preventing Family Violence. She says the report is a major wake-up call for the whole of Australia and both sides of government.
As a country, we're clearly not doing enough to protect our children. And as the report says, there is particular pockets of children that are really suffering disadvantage. For example, asylum seeker children and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. I think all governments have to take responsibility for this report.
And that's Federal Shadow Families and Social Services Minister Linda Burney ending that report from Louise Creeley. And AM also sought a response from the federal government. The Commonwealth is set to unveil what it says is an unprecedented program to help young students with mental health problems. It's injecting almost $100 million into the BU initiative, which helps teachers to identify and assist children who are struggling. Eleanor Whitehead has the story.
It's not all fun and games in the playground. Headmistress Lorraine Bell has seen plenty of students struggle with mental health problems.
Our children present with a variety of concerns and issues. And I think in our society there is more and more pressure through social media, and there's bullying and cyberbullying. And often we do find it difficult.
She's the principal of Monmia Primary School in Melbourne and has learnt what red flags to look for.
It is really important as educators that we know what to identify and we know where to go and get support.
More help is coming to those teachers now as a major new mental health initiative rolls out in Australian schools. It's called BU and is backed by a $98.6 million investment by the federal government.
What this is about is ultimately ensuring that we have better support for teachers. The teachers are better able to support children and their families because we know that 50% of mental health conditions have the early stages developed before somebody is 14, and one in four young people between 15 and 24 has some form of mental health challenge.
Health Minister Greg Hunt says that 2,000 early learning services and 6,000 schools will benefit immediately from this program. That's about a third of the nation's total.
This is a major national rollout. So we're working comprehensively from the earliest years through primary and secondary schooling to ensure that there's support within the school environment, which will protect kids now, but also protect them later on in life when they're adults.
The program offers online courses and mentoring for teachers to help them identify children with problems and connect them to services which can help. It's delivered by the charity Beyond Blue, whose CEO Georgie Harmon says it draws on previous success stories.
We know that there have been some really successful programs running in schools and early learning services for well over a decade. So what BU does is it brings together five current programs into one coherent, single and integrated national initiative.
Lorraine Bell's school is already luckier than many. It was enrolled in one of the programs now replaced by BU called Kids Matter. She says it taught her educators a lot, but the new help will be invaluable.
Every school will be able to access this. Every school will be able to get that support.
That means more of this in Australian playgrounds.
That's Eleanor Whitehead reporting. For a long time, Indigenous leaders and health professionals have thought that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who maintain a strong connection with their land and their culture are generally healthier, but they've not been able to prove it. Now, the Australian National University has launched a study tracking the health and well-being of Indigenous adults. The researchers hope the findings could be used one day to help craft health policies to suit the needs of Indigenous people. Rachel Mealy reports.
The ANU has named the study My Kuai, which means to follow people for a long time. It'll look at how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander well-being is linked to factors like a person's connection to their land, their cultural practices, and their spirituality. Professor Ray Lovett is the lead researcher. He says health statistics about Indigenous people have only told half the story.
So we have quite a bit of data just on health, including health conditions, so things like cardiovascular disease, smoking rate, you know, lots of the statistics we hear often in the media. But what we don't have is the information on cultural knowledge, cultural participation, and questions around identity and what a strong identity looks like.
Professor Lovett says an understanding of how Indigenous people are involved in their culture will help health providers understand what's important for the health and well-being of Aboriginal people.
You know, people from all walks of life, whether you're Aboriginal or not, come from a culture, and we need to be able to understand how that relates and impacts on health and well-being as well.
Indigenous people from around the country will be invited to complete the study on paper, online or over the phone. The researchers hope to have baseline data from the survey available by the middle of next year.
So we know from our pilot studies, but we also know from some other small-scale studies that things like going out on country or language speaking and revitalisation does have impacts on well-being.
Professor Lovett says the study is aiming to influence health policy around Australia by learning what aspects of culture make a positive difference.
So we'll be able to measure, you know, what impact, you know, cultural participation has on reducing, you know, health conditions over that time. But also we are asking about what programs people participate in. And so we're able to mix those two things together to say how they work together to produce better outcomes.
And that's ANU Professor Ray Lovett, ending that report by Rachel Mealy. You're listening to AM, where it's 19 minutes past 8. From today, there is a new authority in charge of dealing with complaints about banks, superannuation and financial institutions. It's called the Australian Financial Complaints Authority. The federal government says it's a one-stop shop and aggrieved customers will get free and fast help with rulings that are binding. The authority was announced last year as Scott Morrison and Malcolm Turnbull pushed back against calls to hold a Banking Royal Commission. The new office is the result of a merger between the Financial Ombudsman Service, the Credit and Investments Ombudsman, and the Superannuation Complaints Tribunal. David Locke is the new ombudsman in charge, and he joined me earlier. David Locke, welcome to the program. Will the banks and financial institutions come to fear you? Hasn't that been part of the problem in the past?
Well, we want to be an independent service that commands trust and confidence from the public, as well as from financial institutions as well. We're the one-stop shop for consumers and small business owners who've got financial disputes. And it's important that our service is not only free for them, but also that we make fair and independent decisions. And if we see misconduct or poor practice, we call that out in a strong and clear way.
Your organisation, though, is the result of a merger of three bodies that really were, well, they were perceived as being pretty ineffective. And going back to that first question again, hasn't that been part of the problem, is that banks and financial institutions in the past have pretty much thumbed their noses at those authorities?
Well, AFCA's a new organisation with a new remit and rules. And the financial thresholds that we've got are significantly increased on what went before. So we can consider any superannuation matter, and our jurisdiction is unlimited. For not superannuation matters, we can consider claims up to $1 million and make binding determinations for up to $500,000. And for small business, that's $5 million as well. So straight away, what you can see is that there are many disputes that couldn't previously come to any ombudsman service that can be dealt with by ourselves. And under the AFCA regime, we have a new reporting framework with regard to systemic issues, and we have to provide much greater transparency to the public about what's going on in organisations, which organisations are generating the disputes and complaints, and what those are about. We'll be working much more closely with the regulators, ASIC, APRA and the ATO, to identify where there's misconduct and put in place measures to address it.
Many Australians have been shocked by the evidence at the Royal Commission. How have you felt listening to some of these witnesses?
Well, I think we've all been shocked by much of the evidence that's been heard. And there's clearly serious issues that have been identified. And I'm sure there will be strong recommendations that come out of the Commission as well. There's lessons for industry, there's lessons for the regulators, and you're right, Sabra, there's lessons for the ombudsman schemes as well.
There are ads in the papers today advising consumers that you're now open for business. How prepared are you to deal with an avalanche of people coming to you now for help in getting compensation and sorting out problems?
Well, we know it's going to be busy. We are working on the assumption we'll be receiving in excess of 55,000 complaints in our first year of operation. But we're well resourced, we're well staffed. We have 550 people and 22 ombudsmen and 14 adjudicators. So we think we're in a pretty good place. The website is live now. People can go to afca.org.au and find out information and lodge a complaint with us. And they can call us after 9 a.m. this morning on 1800 931 678.
For small businesses, complaints that they've had with the banks in the past have been drawn out disputes. The banks have had deeper pockets, and they've had the attitude of trying to draw these out, hoping that they will survive the complainants, that they'll effectively run out of money or go bust. How will you deal with that?
Well, you're right. I think it's been really problematic for many small business owners. They've been in a situation where it's very much been David against Goliath. My parents ran a corner shop for over 35 years, and I've seen how stressful some of these disputes can be for small business owners. And what we know is that cash flow is critical. It's no good getting a solution to your dispute with the bank if that is 18 months, 2 years down the road. The business may well have gone bust by that time. So it's critical that actually timely decisions are made and that compensation is provided quickly where that's appropriate. And we will put a great deal of emphasis on working with small business and small business communities to ensure that our service is fit for purpose.
Will you have benchmarks for sorting those disputes out? Like, will you try and have them done in 2 or 3 months?
Our aim is to conclude the vast majority of disputes within 90 days. Now, if matters are incredibly complicated, have a long history, have multiple issues, it may take longer than that. But certainly the timelines that some of the services in the past have taken just won't cut it.
Now, your new office was announced really prior to the Royal Commission and really as a pushback against having the Royal Commission. Has the focus perhaps of your organisation been diminished because effectively the Royal Commission has now aired a lot of the laundry that the government was hoping you to deal with?
Well, I think what the Royal Commission has demonstrated in graphic terms is the need for such an organisation as ourselves. You can't start to rebuild public trust and confidence in financial institutions unless you've got an avenue for people to go to, somewhere that they can go to if they have a complaint or a dispute and have that independently assessed and fairly treated. So I think it's a precursor to building trust and confidence. And if anything, I think the Royal Commission has demonstrated the very real need for AFCA, and that's why I'm delighted we're launching it today.
David Locks, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thank you very much.
And that's the new Financial Complaints Ombudsman, David Locke. Far North Queensland business owner is feeling the heat of a social media backlash over the name of her fish and chip shop, The Battered Wife. The state's Attorney General has weighed in, saying she's horrified by the name and says it's out of step with community expectations. The fish and chip shop owner says she's a domestic violence survivor and hopes that the shop name shines a light on a very important issue. Anna Hartley reports from Wangan, near Innisfail.
Carolyn Kerr opened the doors of her fish and chip shop near the far north Queensland town of Innisfail 15 months ago. A photo of her shop posted on Facebook by a tourist triggered an online storm. She says she's been shocked by the outrage.
It's the Battered Wife Fish and Chip Shop. Yes, it's a fish and chip shop, but I don't see how they can think it's promoting it when everything that I'm doing is trying to make awareness of it and support it. And if my little shop in the middle of a little town in far north Queensland is causing this much of a ruckus, I hope that they start putting their energy in and trying to change what's going on.
The state's Attorney General couldn't see the positives. Yvette Darr thinks the shop's name is distasteful.
Can I say if there is a business that's chosen to name its shop Battered Wife, I think that's appalling. And that business is completely out of step with what community's expectations are. We're talking about respect. We're talking about changing culture. There's nothing funny about a statement like that.
The state's opposition leader, Deb Frecklington, was asked about the fish shop while at a rally against domestic violence in Brisbane.
We're standing here. I stood side by side with the Premier today in relation to saying no to any form of domestic or sexual violence against families, against children, and it is completely unacceptable that in our communities that we have anything that goes towards an encouragement of violence against women.
Shop owner Carolyn Kerr says she brings a unique perspective to the issue of domestic violence as she's both a former police officer and a domestic violence survivor.
At the end of the day, you find yourself, I found myself, it was almost like I turned bipolar, you know, my brain's telling me, you know, what the devil are you doing, get out, why are you here? And the heart's going, oh, but I love him, you know, he'll change, you know, and it just really mucks with your whole psyche. And eventually I just looked at my kids and thought they deserve better.
Miss Kerr says it's ironic that she was forced to close the shop early a few nights ago after receiving online threats of violence.
It's just crazy. Everybody that's being abusive and confronting, they're the ones that condemn the violence and the abuse, and yet they're the ones that are presenting it to me, you know. I'm certainly not a victim anymore, and I look at what I've built and I'm so proud of myself for building what I have, you know. And if I can make a difference, then if people are listening to this, you know, stop slapping your missus, stop belting your husband, if that's the case. Look at your kids and work out what's best.
That's shop owner Carolyn Kerr ending Anna Hartley's report. In finance now, the National Australia Bank has just announced a full-year after-tax profit of $5.5 billion. That's up 5%. The NAB also noted a charge of $231 million to compensate customers amid the fallout from the Banking Royal Commission. Wall Street's rebounded as investors snapped up tech and internet stocks. The Dow Jones has closed almost 1% higher, and the Australian dollar is weaker. It's trading at 70.7 US cents. That's AM for today. I'm Sabra Lane. It's 8:30.